Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the Courage Conversation Show. I'm your host, Ashley Easter. I am the founder and executive director of Courage 365, and we have a great show planned for you today. Courage 365 is a group where we love supporting survivors. We talk about empowerment, about healing, about bringing survivors and advocates together. And that's actually really what this conversation is going to be about today. The person we're interviewing is Dominique Benninger. And he actually is both a survivor of cults and an advocate that's very prolific in the field. And I'm so excited to have him on the show today. He's also one of our Courage Club facilitators, and his wife, Megan, is a Courage Club facilitator. They are such a great power couple. And if you're not already following them, like, you're totally going to want to do it after this interview. Without further ado, let me go ahead and read this bio so we can get Dom onto the show. Dominique Benninger has survived spiritual abuse in a variety of institutional settings, including a religious cult, a charismatic non-denominational church, and a Southern Baptist church. Dominique co-founded Baptist Accountability, an online database that tracks abuse within Baptist churches. Dominique holds a bachelor's in psychology from Messiah College, as well as a master's degree in cybersecurity and information assurance with West Governors University. Dominique has studied the psychological aspects of human hacking and social engineering in relation to spiritual abuse. Dom, welcome to the show. How are you?
Ashley, I'm well, thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm so good. I've been looking forward to this interview, and I just know it's going to be so good. I've heard bits of your story, but to be able to have you on the show to share, it's going to be great.
Awesome.
Yeah. So my first question for you is, I feel like you've survived a ton of either cults or high control groups, whether they fall into cults or not. I'll leave that up for you to decide. But just in your bio, there's the charismatic non-denominational church. There's a Southern Baptist church, as well as an all-out religious cult. My understanding is that one was in college. And so I'm wondering, can you give us like a quick overview of where you come from with all that? And then also where you're at today?
Sure. No, thank you, Ashley. So it's very complicated. I have a very long history of encountering what's often called high control groups. That started out as I was a child in a single parent home. There was physical and emotional abuse going on and things like that. So when I first started exploring spirituality in my own life, I started attending a charismatic Episcopal church. I was around 12 years old, and that may make your brain hurt a little bit, but it's actually fairly common that some branches within the Episcopal church are very charismatic, meaning that they believe in the outpouring of spirituality and the Holy Spirit and things like that. So I started attending this church, and it was, for me, life-giving on many different levels. So I was immediately pulled in, obviously, by what's classically called love bombing, but just that sense of belonging and feeling, wow, these people really care about me. And I believe to this day that they genuinely did, but it was pulling me inward into this vortex of control. And as I got older, I noticed just strange things would happen as I became like a high schooler. We would drive home from, say, church, and my mom would just be crying in the seat beside me. And I just never really understood what was going on. But there were elements of those like control elements taking place all throughout that I just never was aware of. And it took me years to maybe look back and recognize it for what it was. I went to college. I attended Messiah College down here in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area. And it was an extension of me trying to find, one is what I wanted to do with my life, right? And two was, how can I connect on a deeper level with my spirituality? And so Messiah is a great school. It's now Messiah University. And I attended there all 4 years. About halfway through my career at Messiah, if you will, my tenureship as a student, I met Megan. It's a fantastic story how we met. Is I accidentally hit her in the eye with a fork, a plastic fork. There was love at first fork, and it was a total accident. She was in a snack shop. I was in a snack shop. I'm supposed to keep this brief, but that's how I met Megan. I met her by hitting her in the head, in the eye, actually, with a plastic fork. Being the smooth operator that I am, I followed up with a bouquet of non-threatening purple daisies and asked her out on a date. I wrote her a poem. It was the whole thing, right? It was very smooth.
So sweet. I love it. Yeah. And it's also very church boy.
Yeah, that was me, was church boy. And everything had to be just right. And I was so devout in my spirituality at that point. Like, my high school youth leader nicknamed me Pope. He would call me Pope, and he said, "You're going to be the first Episcopal Pope." Like, I was so sold out to spirituality and taking it seriously. So yeah, I was the good church boy guy. And I met Megan, and we began dating, and bada bing, we were a couple, we were engaged. And while we were students at Messiah, there was an on-campus Bible study group called Narrowgate. And just the name now in retrospect, Neurogate, it should have been a little that this was maybe a little sketchy. But look, Megan and I were seekers, and we still are seekers, right? And just trying to figure out this complex thing called spirituality in our lives. We flirted with the group a little bit, attended a few times just to get a feel for what it was about. Once again, like there was a lot of love bombing. People were just, oh my goodness, we're so happy to see you come in. It was immediately drawing us into that family feeling. And that was always a vulnerability, if you will, in me looking for a safe family environment because I came from a broken home. And I don't want to speak for Megan, her coming from a kind of a single parent home and things like that. We both had similar things that we were after in life. And that sense of belonging and the love bombing, that was strong sauce, right? So we started flirting and then we started seriously attending this group, this Bible study. We got pulled into kind of, they had an inner circle. And what really struck us a lot about it was just the leader was so charismatic. Just everything about him, he was a seeker and he was sold out for God and wanted to know God personally. And that was such a draw for us as well, that sense of wanting to belong. And it was very charismatic. And so it got into different areas that were very questionable with Messiah College. So there were some initial schisms with Messiah. Was certainly, they taught a lot of Bible classes and they were very serious about academics as well as spirituality and how they could interrelate. This group was gradually drawing us more towards being serious spiritually at the expense of academics. Some people quit college during the course of this group, this Bible study. And over time, where the shades of gray became dark enough that it became a cult is really hard to say. And to this day, I still don't know exactly when did this become a cult, but absolutely become a cult it did, to the extent that it was kicked off campus. The leader, and he married us. So we were engaged. We got married by this leader. We weren't allowed to meet on campus. So we met off campus. And once that happened, things escalated very quickly within the group to the point where they were moving people in with other people. There was a lot of control over finances. And there was a very high pressure of our group is the only group that has it right. And if you leave us, you're basically walking away from God. So there was no real way out. And eventually the group exploded rather fantastically in that the leader of the group, or the cult leader, if you will, started teaching that marriage was not of God. And it came out eventually that he was, though he had a wife and a daughter, he was sleeping with or having sex with another congregant or person in the cult.
Of course.
The whole group blew up. Ultimately, it usually comes down to those kind of things. And that's a pattern we've seen again and again over our career in religion, if you will. We left the cult. The cult blew up fantastically. And we had severe trauma from that, but we didn't know how to recognize that. So what usually happens, or at least it certainly happened in our case, is we jumped right out of one high control group and into another control group because it felt safe and familiar. So we started attending a non-denominational charismatic church in the area. They took us right in and they were so welcoming and so kind to us, and the love bombing kicked in, right? And oh, now we have a new family. Their approach was neuothetic or biblical counseling. And what that means, that's a shorthand for not dealing with the problems at all and just covering it up in the backyard, right? Putting some Bible verses on it and oh, it's fixed. Oh, and by the way, don't ever look back because then you're not standing in faith and stuff. So we never dealt with our cult experience ever. We attended this church. It was very high control. They would go through our finances to make sure we were tithing 10% off the gross, just all this stuff. And it was a repeat, though obviously not to the extent of the cult, but it was a repeat of that kind of high control and controlling not just how you acted, but how you thought. And layering on those layers of guilt and shame. So I have to look and act just like everyone else, or there is a level of shame and shunning and things like that. So we left that church. We literally hid in the back pew of a mega church for a few months. At this time, Megan and I were starting a family. So we had two little critters. We now have five. So that pattern kept going, right? So we started a family. We started attending a Southern Baptist church in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Again, the pattern repeated itself. Love bombing. We were drawn to the wise mentor church leader, the pastor, wonderful man. And he was a genuine, he took his spirituality very seriously. And we were drawn in, like it was another father figure for us, for Megan and I, that frankly, we've been looking for that. We attended the Southern Baptist Church for roughly, I want to say 12 years-ish. And we started noticing as the church went from one pastor to two pastors to five pastors for a church of 100 people. And there was a lot of conflict going on and stuff like that. And we eventually left. And that's when we found out that the one pastor was a convicted child sex offender, and it had been covered up for many years. Like leadership knew about it and they did not notify anyone. We didn't even know. And there were all these little things, like I was in church leadership throughout the duration of our being there. And there were weird incidents that were happening that just didn't make sense apart from the context. And once I found out the context of this one pastor is the superintendent of the school there, and some of the weird things that were going on in the context of him being a convicted child sex offender, oh, now it makes sense. And so all that to say, we became unwilling whistleblowers. We were very adamant that, look, people, as parents, we firmly believed that other parents needed to have all the information so that they could determine, is this a safe place for my children? And is this a safe place for me, for my family, et cetera? And we firmly believed that. There was some pushback. And you see that pattern repeated again and again in the news every day within the SBC, but within other religious denominations. We became whistleblowers. It ended poorly for us. The pastor resigned with much sorrow and then was preaching in another Southern Baptist church down the road within months. And there was no accountability. That's a big word. And we were left trying to chase after this situation. Oh, another church. And oh, guess what? They didn't notify the parents. And he's around children and the parents don't know and stuff like that. So what that led to for us was more whistleblowing, more ostracizing, more, we were doxxed on Twitter, car tires slashed, or someone drilled screws into car tires, just all this crazy stuff happening to us. And so we made the front page of USA Today with our story, which was a big deal for us. We had wanted people just to know what's going on so that they can make the best decisions in the interest of protecting their children, protecting their family. We got that by being front page USA Today. That led to us addressing the issue head on of where is the accountability within. Our focus was very specific, and it was SBC churches, because this church was an SBC church, and the church he went to, I believe that was SBC as well, but it was Baptist churches. And that's how we found the works of the writings of Krista Brown. We started attending like our first Courage Club meeting down in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And that set us on the path of advocacy, where we were learning of the systemic issues of power, control, abuse, cover up, all of that stuff that had been a pattern all throughout all of our religious wanderings, if you will. And Megan and I were discussing, like, how can this happen? How can someone who's convicted and literally did jail time for harming or abusing a child become a school principal over children? And what is going on? And so we were greatly motivated by the works of Krista Brown. We've talked to Krista on numerous times. She's just a wonderful person. And she had started a work of Stop Baptist Predators. And so that was an online kind of tracking mechanism. And she had laid that down at one point. It was just too much for her to keep going. And the question Megan and I asked ourselves was, why can't we do something like that? And I work in IT and with computers, and I'm like, no way, you could never do that. But then it burrowed into my skull. It just kept working on me. And I'm like, it could be done. And it turns out it really wasn't that hard to do. And so within just a few months, we stood up an online database. We began populating it based on publicly available information from news articles, from online newspapers, from Krista's own database. At this point in time, the great work was Mr. Down in Texas and the Abuse of Faith online database. And there were several other databases just cropping up across the environment, like Bishop Accountability and MapList, and all these different databases were facing the same challenges of how do we keep these people accountable. So all that to say, we started Baptist Accountability. It's been up and operational for a few years now. It's been, there's just so much to it, right? Becoming advocates so quickly and overnight, dealing with all of this systemic stuff that we've been dealing with, and really having to parse out how do people within the SBC, for example, move around, and what are some of the mechanisms they use to stay under the radar? Maybe the church is SBC, and then so the pastor moves to maybe an IFB church or an independent fundamentalist. So they would, people, you know, with allegations would tend to weave in and out of different denominations, non-denominational, IFB, SBC, Conservative Baptist, CB, or whatever. But they would also, churches would end and then crop up under new names and things like that. So there were all these different ways that we had to parse out, like, how do you even track someone? Because the goal is to be able to identify someone and what's going on so that people can make informed decisions. If the church is changing name and the denomination is changing, and today they're in the SBC, tomorrow they're not in the SBC, and then they rejoin. All these things were very complicated that we just had to say, look, this is where we're going to start, and we'll adapt and grow with this. So that was our work with Baptist Accountability. The database is still online today. Since then, the SBC has been having its own, shall I say, reckoning. Yeah. They're facing this, and Guidepost is working on building a database and things like that. So we've been very transparent all along that however we can help the SBC or help Guidepost or help anyone that wants to do a similar approach to trying to provide accountability within these religious or sacred spaces, we're here to help. And that's what motivates us, is trying to help people. So that's where we're at today. And I hope I've covered all the main points, but yeah, that's our journey.
Wow. That was such a thorough overview. And I know it's hard to compress so many years into one interview, but I think you did a great job. And
thank you.
I just want to follow up in a couple of areas because your story is so fascinating and you and Megan are so brave in having gone through all these things and then turning around and creating resources and protection and safety for other people. It's really amazing. But as I'm looking at your story, I'm seeing that you're this charismatic Episcopal church, which I didn't know existed. The Episcopal church I visited and Episcopal priests that I've known have been very straight-laced and all like along the lines of Catholic, everything has a particular order and everything's very strict. But you started there. You then had the cult in the college. You then had the high control group that was also charismatic. And then from there, you go into the Southern Baptist group where there's also control and abuse cover-ups. And I guess I have two questions. What do you think was the thing that kept you going into these different groups? Was there a similarity that you were able to pick out, like a through line that you saw that was like, this is the thing that keeps pulling us back in? And are you even able to identify that?
Yeah, 25 years-ish since the cult. And we finally started going to real therapy. And what I mean by real therapy is a professional licensed therapist. And furthermore, someone who maybe understood power dynamics and had some understanding of trauma. And all of these things that we had gone through, like we just didn't know. I could go out and buy a car. Any car will do. That doesn't necessarily map over into therapy. Like, you don't even know what you're looking for or what you're asking for. We bumbled around a little bit in the beginning of it, but it's been very valuable us learning what has been motivating us to your question, why? And I'm fortunate that my undergrad work was in psychology and understanding human behavior. And there was always this little thing on my shoulder, this little nagging voice that's you read about that, Dami. And moving into my grad work on hacking, and it all lined up with the concept that I was being hacked my whole life. And what does that really mean? Breaking that down into, I had specific things that I was looking for in life. And in the computer world, those are called vulnerabilities, right? And someone knew how to exploit them and to use those to control me. So that's boiling it down as low as I could possibly do it, but not recognizing that there was such an overlap between all of the environments that I went into, whether it was a charismatic Episcopal church, non-denominational evangelical church, banning Harry Potter and that whole thing, that whole culture, or a extreme cult, which it was an extreme cult all the way out to the SBC level. There were very obvious similarities between all of them. And what it boiled down to for me was beginning to identify not that there was something wrong with me, that I was a bad person or wrong per se, but understanding that there were motivations I had in my life, things that I wanted out of life, and people were promising me those things as a means to their own ends. So there was a whole lot to unpack there. It's been a journey, right? So where I'm at today is different from where I was at, say, 3 years ago when we left the Baptist church or whatever. It's been a journey, but it's been a very enriching journey. So I think I covered the first question, right? And it's, there were things in me that I had brought to the table and put out there, and people used those against me to be able to control me. And forgive me, Ashley, I know it was a two-part question.
It was a confusing question. You answered, I think, all of it, but mainly I was wondering, like, if there were through lines in the cult and if there was something that you noticed that kept pulling you in. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense because as a cult survivor myself, I agree. Like, people who get sucked into cults, it's not because they're bad. It's not because they're dumb or stupid. Like, you don't join a cult because you're like, oh, let's join a cult. Let's get trauma and abuse. Yes. Woo. Yeah. Nobody does that. Yeah. But cults are so good at offering good things up front, or at least promising good things up front. Even Scientology, they've got a personality test that's not that bad. And So that makes sense. And then I was listening as you were sharing your story and you're talking about that love bombing. And it seems that was a really effective strategy. If you had experiences in your life where you didn't feel like you had the full scope of love that you desired in your childhood, if somebody promises that to you, why wouldn't you take that? And then what are the chances you'll get into a bad thing again? So somebody else promises, it seems like the chances are low, but it's almost like a pipeline that I see people go through from these really extreme groups to other things that I would say are on a spectrum of a cult, but maybe on the lesser, more acceptable end of it, but still very damaging. And so that's really helpful to understand. And I think that's a lesson for everybody tuning in. Your vulnerabilities don't make you a bad person, but you do need to recognize that you have those vulnerabilities and that you're feeding those things and those needs in your life with healthy, safe things, because any of us could be vulnerable to a cult if they push our right button.
Yeah. And that's a good point. And it's worth digging into a little bit. And it's the concept that this is like a spectrum, right? So across all of the different environments, whether it was Episcopal, charismatic Episcopal, non-denominational, evangelical, cult, right? That obviously is like cult bad, but it's a spectrum. And even SBC, like those concepts that they used were all pretty common. Like I keep mentioning love bombing, and who doesn't want to be loved? Who doesn't want to feel like they have value and someone cares about them being there? That's not a bad thing at all. But being aware of how those can be taken advantage of and understanding that even a good, and I'll use the term a good church, right? Maybe one that isn't being deliberately harmful to others, they may be using these techniques that have been harmful for others, and they may not even know they're doing it. Walking into just your average church on a Sunday morning, obviously, they're going to have greeters and welcome you and want you to feel welcome. Those are love bombing techniques, right? And they're not, I doubt they're intending that to draw you in and take your money and stuff. But looking at things so much differently now of where I'm at versus where I was 5, 10, 15 years ago, there are so many elements of these harmful cult tactics, if I can call them that, high control group. Cult is such a heavy word. And I appreciate the work of experts in the field like Stephen Hassan, who maybe using the word cult is too heavy, and maybe high control groups and things like that. So all that to say, there are common elements that are even in good churches, and they may not be aware. You know, they may be wondering right now, don't you want to be greeted at the door? Don't you want to feel welcome? They don't understand because maybe they haven't been harmed. And there are a lot of people that have been harmed through these environments. It's valuable for someone, if you attend what you believe is a good, safe church, understanding how some of those techniques that may be used to harm or control people, like that they're there, just that they're not maybe being extremely used, but shunning someone because they read Harry Potter, right? Or, oh, you came in and you're not wearing a tie. There's such a continuum of these control techniques. And when it crosses into being harmful or not harmful, it's really down to the individual to decide, not the religious leaders, those in power.
That's an excellent thing. And I also think I was actually doing an interview with Cindy Brandt, and she was talking about empowering children. And we were talking about healthy versus unhealthy parenting techniques. And I'm like, what if you need to get your kid in the car and they don't want to put their shoes on? But if they don't get in the car, they won't get to school on time. If they don't get to school on time, you won't get to work on time. And then you won't have money to take care of the child. And I was like, how do you approach that in a non-controlling way? And she was saying that a lot of times the end result will be the same. The child needs to put their shoes on even when they don't want to. But a lot of it comes down to the motivation and the language that's used. And one could be, you better get in the car because I'm your parent and I said kind of thing. And the other could be, hey, we need to have a collaborative approach to this. And I want you to do this because I need to take care of you. And this is a step towards that. And so I even think, like with the greeting thing, I think I would be off-put if I went into a new club of any kind and nobody came up and said hi. But a lot of it comes down to that motivation of, are they trying to trap you here? Are they trying to give you a false sense of security when something's really not safe? And just being able to notice those things. Another thing I just had a question about, because you've been in some charismatic groups and some Baptist groups, the word cult was not even really accessible to me for a long time because they redefined that word for me. And when I heard the word cult, a lot of people would say a cult is anything that does not have our ideology and is not, I'm trying to think of the word, is not orthodox. Anything that's not orthodox is a cult. And they would focus on the beliefs versus the actions and the control. And sometimes beliefs can be toxic, but a lot of times people can have the correct beliefs, even in very liberal PC environments where everybody's doing and saying the quote right thing, there can still be toxic abusive elements in those environments. Right. I'm just curious, was the word cult used the way we're using it, which is like high control group using these tactics, or was it something else based?
It's a tricky question. And we did this when we were in the cult. We would drag things into a definitions semantics game so that we could feel better about ourselves, most absolutely notably in a cult. And if the word cult came up, no, we're not a cult, and we would reframe what cult is so that we wouldn't, the term cognitive dissonance, right? You hear something and you're like, this makes me uncomfortable. What do you do with that? That's the high level definition of cognitive dissonance. We did a lot of amazing things to get around our own cognitive dissonance. And look, the group was kicked off campus and people came to us and said, dude, you're in a cult. And
no, not us.
And because we would reframe things, and ultimately, can I say, like, the SBC church was a cult? Again, it's going to get dragged into semantics where it's more valuable. And you just made this point, and it's, what is the effect it's having on other people? And cult being a loaded word, just, it's almost obsolete technology. It's almost obsolete language that we've robbed it of even knowing what that means. Moving to a paradigm like high control that shifts the focus to what is the effect it's having on other people, which is very valuable. It's just, as an example, a practical one of the kid doesn't get in the car. I may use different techniques with the same result. And in a church or a religious group, I may use the same techniques and be getting different results. Common religious teaching is looking at the fruit coming from the tree, right? And that's almost a better approach when looking at the environment and the effect it's having on others, because looking at the fruit or looking at the effect this group or religious church or fill in the blank, it could be a country club or it could be anything. It could be harming people by the techniques that not just individuals, but maybe an entire environment. It may be built from the ground up on certain principles that can be deemed harmful and stuff. So it really is important. One is breaking down the language, and two is shifting the focus from the institution down to what I'll say the fruit. And I don't want to minimize people and say, oh, you're just an apple, man.
But it's the harm that is being caused to people versus, right. I think that is really an interesting language shifting thing that really could help advance conversations. Yeah. And one thing I would say just as a tip, as people are like evaluating the fruit, you may need to leave the group to be able to evaluate the fruit. Because again, with the language switching and the semantics and the mind-bending techniques they use, you may think something is a good piece of fruit because they're telling you this is what qualifies as a good piece of fruit. And getting perspective outside can really be able to reframe that. One more question I want to ask you, and I'm sure we could go for a long time about this, but it's, you talk about human hacking and social engineering, and also how those overlap with spiritual abuse. That is such a fascinating concept to me. Tell me what that is. And do you feel like your brain was hacked by a cult?
Without a doubt. And the studies, wow, there's so much to this one, right? This could be several hours. They have conclusively determined, based on social psychology principles, that I'll take just a real low-level example. You ring a bell and show a dog food, and the dog drools. And before long, you ring the bell and the dog will salivate. There are responses that are very common to creatures, and I'm choosing my words carefully. That same principle absolutely applies to human beings, right? And I go up to Ashley and I say, oh, I found money under the floorboard and I don't need it. I just want to give it to you. And knowing that, like, they've done studies of people will almost always try to reciprocate because they'll feel some level of being indebted, right? And that's absolutely true in my own life. Someone gives me something or says, oh, dude, I know you were looking for a car. I've got an extra car. You can borrow it or something. And you feel indebted to them and you want to pay them back in some way. You want to reciprocate. That's almost ingrained into the programming of humans. And that's just one of a kajillion examples of studies. They've done studies on power, and it's pretty very famous, like the prison studies that they've done, that now that they're like, oh my goodness, like giving someone power almost always will corrupt the person that has the power. They will almost always, without exception, and I'm sure maybe there are exceptions, but in the studies, like, it's it corrupts people and it changes how they look at and approach other people. So there are so many studies in this area, and connecting the dots into the religious realm of how people get results, religious leaders get results. People are absolutely using techniques everywhere in life, whether it's in a religious environment or whether it's in a company, a business, motivational speeches and all that stuff. They're using techniques that get results. And is that a bad thing or is that just a thing? That I think comes back to, what is the fruit of that? Are we manipulating people to harm them for our own personal gain, like financially? Am I expecting money back from you if I let you borrow my car or something? All of these things, what is the effect that it's having on people? And that's really what it, I think that the shift or the focus really needs to move over into that realm, because it doesn't seem like we're really getting anywhere going any other way, because it's pulling it into the weeds and the semantics, so to speak. And people that are in a position of power, they'll tend to do that so that they don't have to relinquish that power. It's tricky. But Ashley, this is literally a topic that social psychologists have been studying for hundreds of years. And it absolutely applies to every area of our lives, from marketing, turning on the TV, Facebook ads, into the realm of religion. I want, as a religious leader, I want to make a living from this. So I'm going to guilt you into tithing 10% off the gross. Like, the techniques are all there, and they seem to be ingrained into what makes us humans. What is the fruit of that? Are people using those to control / harm / manipulate and take advantage of us?
I have so many thoughts on this.
I know.
That's really fascinating, truly. And I'm thinking about this on a lot of different levels, because I've been trained in NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming. And I use it with my clients in our one-on-one coaching sessions. And the purpose of using it is to help them overcome limiting beliefs and blocks that are holding them back from success in certain areas of their life. And phrasing sentences a certain way, or doing particular things like creating trigger points on our body, can actually help us release like dopamine and those pleasure centers and make us more likely to achieve the things we've set out to. But I've also seen those same type of techniques used by cult leaders in dangerous environments to get a person to basically do whatever the leader is going to say. And it seems the difference there is, number one, the transparency, but number two, really, again, going back to the motivation of it, looking at the fruit, like you said, because helping somebody see a bigger picture so that they can achieve the dreams that they've already set out for themselves, or helping somebody see a bigger picture so they can fulfill your ideals for your cult-like group. Like, it's so interesting. And like you said, it just is, and it's a human thing. But I also feel like there's a piece of hope there, because these church services, these cultic groups, they make you feel a certain kind of way. Usually initially it feels good. And right. So when you lose that, you feel like, okay, there were these bad things that happened, but I can never feel that ecstasy, that elation. Actually, you can, because if you can learn those different trigger points on yourself, you can get yourself into states in healthy ways. You can feel that connection and that love and that oneness. It doesn't have to be connected to a cult. And when you realize this isn't something like a superpower this cultic leader has, or this isn't them making God do this for you because you followed the rules, I feel like on one hand, it's scary to know it exists, but on the other hand, it's relieved to know that like I can feel good and create motivation in myself without having to be connected to these toxic groups. I don't know. That's what came to my mind.
And that's great. And there are so many layers of overlap here. And my whole life, I've been a musician and I've been a worship leader. And music is a beautiful thing. And I love music and I'm very involved in music. So there's layers of overlap where I have recognized that I've used music to maybe soften people up, and not deliberately choosing to do that. Just by its very nature, the phrasing or the staging of it, how it was approached was, look, we're going to worship together for 20 minutes. And knowing that what songs you end off on and the creating and releasing tension musically, how we used that just musically, and that was a good thing. That wasn't a good or bad thing, but then that immediately would set the pastor up to, oh, now we're going to give, or now it's so complicated, and breaking it out. There were layers of that were good, and there were layers of that were bad, and there were layers that I just didn't even know. And coming out of that, to your point of not necessarily this being a good or a bad thing, it's a thing, but also apart from these environments, I can get the same level of, and let's just call it what it is, like a dopamine burst in the brain, those feel good chemicals. I can get that from being in a worship service, hands in the air, lights dimmed, sparkly glitter, the whole thing. I can get that from petting my cat. So,
or going to a Beyonce concert.
Beyonce concert, or eating a good meal, or looking at the sunset, being moved by the beauty of nature. I was hacked into believing that the only way I could experience that was through a very specific narrow focus of what the religious environment around me wanted me to believe. You got to break out of that or you can't be free. You'll be controlled in those environments. And it's not that you're bad, right? It's that you're human and these things are, we're wired certain ways to appreciate beauty and for someone to use beauty to keep you within their narrow focus so that they can get your money, get your support. You will absolutely follow and support someone. Even if they're an abuser, this is being proven the case. People will support an abuser because of how that abuser made them feel or how they helped. These things are common in every area of our lives. I think there's a lot of value in recognizing how these components of what makes us human, identifying them, and part of that will naturally lead to you being less hackable once you see it.
Wow. Less hackable. That sounds like a goal.
Yeah. I'm pointing words. I'm going to copyright that one.
Less hackable. That sounds like a book. John, this has been great. Last question. This is like a quick one for you. What does courage mean to you?
What does courage mean to me? It's a very personal question. It's a beautiful question. For me, it's being true to myself in spite of the pressures around me, right? Courage to do what's right, even if it's a hard thing, because I got to sleep at night. Courage is doing what's right, even if it's a hard thing or a scary thing, or if it's going in opposition to the way I'm currently being hacked. Maybe speaking out on, look, this music is totally torquing me in a certain direction, and having the courage to recognize it and maybe stop. That for me is courage. It's a very personal question, but it's a beautiful question.
That's so amazing. I love it so much. Don, where can people find you and your work?
Currently, they can find me in my basement hiding out here, but that's not your question. No, we being Megan and I founded BaptistAccountability.org, which is an online database. You can also read about my cult experiences on churchtrauma.org. That's more of a blog where Megan and I just share our processing of all of this stuff, a lifetime of walking through these experiences. Megan has her poetry and whatnot there, which is absolutely amazing. The cult blog is a work in progress, but it's there. So churchtrauma.org is another place.
Excellent. Dom, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. You truly are a courageous person, and we're so thankful for you here at Courage 365.
Thank you, Ashley. I appreciate the opportunity just to share. This is what it's really all about for me, right? Why else did I go through all this bizarre crap if not being able to help others maybe lessen their load or identify maybe areas that they're being hacked and finding their own personal courage to maybe walk in a different direction than they've always walked before? So thank you for this opportunity.
My pleasure. And everybody, after you're done following Megan and Dom's work online, please make sure that you're following Courage 365 on all the social media accounts. We've got Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, all the different places you can find us. And of course, Courage365.org has a ton of free resources. We've got a Need Help tab if you're in a crisis situation. We have a free resource section where you can download free ebooks and trainings and courage cards and all kinds of cool stuff. It's all there for you. We've even got a Facebook group where we have great conversations inside of them. But my very favorite resource that we have is our text message list. We send out inspirational text messages Monday through Friday. They're totally and completely free. They're written by survivors for survivors to really help you step into the new day feeling courageous, feeling supported, feeling connected, and knowing that you're not alone. And to sign up for these, again, they're free. We don't spam you. All you have to do is text the word courage to the number on the screen, which is 917-809-7311. Again, text the word courage to 917-809-7311. And when you do that, you'll automatically be added to our list. No spam, no messages from other survivors, just from us. And if you happen to hit reply on one of those messages, there's somebody behind the phone that will often reply back to you. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Please be sure to give this episode a share. And as always, live with courage.